Welcome to the Philip Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:05 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 10th, and it's Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off and just ruminate a little bit on the yield curve spread, because the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month became much more inverted than the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year did, although both were inverted ahead of the end of the year. And they've been reliable lead indicators for future recessions for most of the last few decades. And that was despite the fact that nobody knew anything about the coronavirus becoming a global phenomenon in the second half of last year. And yet, we certainly had this lead indicator that there was a recession brewing. So that already tells us that we were being set up with conditions that have historically been quite reliable in terms of warning that there's going to be a recession. That liquidity conditions had already been tightening. The problems with the repo market back in September, October were a clear indication that there was tightness in global liquidity markets. The market response to that has been to effectively for the Federal Reserve to step in and backstop the entire market. Now, that opens up the Federal Reserve to literally unlimited liability. And that is obviously a condition that we need to have some form of consideration for, because whereas previously it was assumed that the Federal Reserve was the central banker to the world, now they are effectively the central banker to the world, and the quantity of money that could be potentially demanded through the repo market dwarfs what is potentially demanded by any individual single market. And I think that that is perhaps one of the most of the biggest reasons, or the appreciation for the size of just how much money could be created, is part of the reason why we've had this substantial rebound in markets. Now, we can certainly see the inversions when it drops below zero. There was, I think, an interesting graphic that was produced by DoubleLine, and this was really all the way back in December of 2018, and they were pointing out a similar condition, that when the yield on the 3-month Treasury bill exceeds that on the global broad bond markets, then, generally speaking, volatility is what follows. So that's exactly what we've had. We're now in a condition where global interest rates have compressed pretty much right across the board. Now, when we look at the yield on, for example, the futures contract, or the money market futures contract in the USA, well, then we're still around the 25 basis point level. You have to go to places like Brazil for 2% or Mexico for 5%. And that, I think, is probably one of the more interesting markets right now, because the Mexican peso has been strengthening, and it's possible to pick up a 5% yield on 3-month paper, which is obviously something that is likely to encourage risk-tolerant investors. Then when we look at Europe, we see that there are a number of markets have got negative yields, but we've got deep negative yields, for example, in Switzerland, down to a negative 72 basis points, or the Eurozone minus 45. What was interesting today is that at 90-day sterling was, in fact, in negative territory, but on the 2021 futures, the July 2021 futures, got right up to 100, which is effectively negative interest rates. And the bigger picture here is that Japan has been in negative rates for a while. Australia and New Zealand, which have historically been considered to be high interest rate countries, have also seen their interest rate futures decline very meaningfully. Now, then let's just skip around and look at what the relative bond futures are looking like. And we can also see here that it is Europe where we have got the vast majority of the negative interest rates. They are not highlighting the yield for the Japanese 10-year, but it's in mild positive territory because of yield control. But then when we look at everywhere else, for example, the Korean 10-year is still trading at about 1.4%, and it's not as if South Korea is going to default. But of course, then there is the question about the efficacy of any decision based upon the currency and how steady is the currency likely to be. Then we've also seen a massive compression in yields in Australia and indeed in New Zealand. But compared to what's available in most of Europe, then what's available in Australia is still comparatively attractive. Then we can also consider that the imputed yield from the future on the long bond is substantially higher than what you can see on the 10-year. And this is rather interesting, that there is a very significant difference between the ultra future on the 10-year and the actual 10-year. When we then think about what exactly we are being offered on the yield, it's at a rather compressed level, somewhere in between, about 63 basis points. Now, yields did steady in here today from the lower side of the range, but the longer we look at some of these pressures that are on the global market, the fact that you have this extraordinary commonality of yield compression all over the world, then the big question that investors need to start to think about, or at least give some sort of consideration to, is what happens when the whole world goes into a period of extraordinarily low interest rates? How are investors going to be able to capture a yield? This is, I think, one of the most important questions, and it's particularly relevant for the UK right now. When we look at the yield curve for the UK, we can see that bond yields are in negative territory now, out to maturities of about 7 years. But on a 10-year, you only get 15 basis points, and on a 40-year, you get 57. 30 years, more than that. Well, the question then is, what is the UK going to do? Are they going to increase the size of the balance sheet, or are they going to go into negative territory? When we think about what exactly other central banks have done, it's been a mix of both. The size of the Bank of England's balance sheet has expanded really quite substantially over the course of the last while. It's murderously difficult to find the ticker for the UK. So I'm going to just go pull it up in the chart library. It's just a lot easier to do that. But when we think about what exactly they are likely to do, the Bank of England has said they're reluctant to lower interest rates into negative territory, because one of the things that it does is it hamstrings the banking sector. Banks can't possibly make a margin on their business when there is a clear incentive by central banks to to withdraw any way that they can make money. So the Bank of England's balance sheet did nothing at all for years before March of this year, and they have been changing the ticker so that it was rather difficult to monitor. It was really only when they started expanding the balance sheet again that we saw there was a clear change in the ticker. but it has gone from 450 billion to 700 billion pounds in the space of 3 months. Now, it has paused somewhat over the course of the last week. But what this also tells us is that if the Bank of England is not going to be willing to go into negative interest rates, then they're going to have to massively increase the size of the balance sheet. And I think that that is probably what we're going to get. That there is going to, and that is really what we're also seeing from bond yields, it's what we're seeing from interest rate futures, that the bond market is willing to bet that despite the fact that we have had this very impressive rebound in markets, that we're quite likely to have a deflationary outlook for at least the next while, and that when that has or at least that could last for a couple of years based upon what the bond market is predicting, there will be continued downward pressure on interest rates, and the size of the balance sheets of central banks will continue to increase. Now, when we look at the size of those balance sheets, we're up to approximately $26 trillion. Because of the fact that the UK is now reporting their data again, I've been able to add it into this measure. It hasn't changed the shape at all because of the timing of the increase, but certainly the totals have increased. I've also added in Australia, because Australia has also been engaging in quantitative easing again. But of course, the other point is that we've had a really quite substantial change in how central banks are really thinking in terms of what they can in fact get away with in terms of policy. Because the number of global central banks that have engaged in quantitative easing has increased really very substantially. And we have got a number of we've got a number of emerging markets that are now engaged in quantitative easing. Just turning this graphic around, we can see now that of all the central banks that have cut interest rates, there are about 10 more that are also engaging in quantitative easing, everywhere from Poland to Ghana to the Philippines, Chile, Turkey, Colombia, Thailand, South Africa, Egypt, Hungary, Romania, Indonesia, and South Korea are all engaged in quantitative easing. And to a greater or lesser extent, their currencies are being rewarded for taking some of the risk away from the economy. The Indonesian rupiah, for example, collapsed in the early part of the year and then regained almost the entire decline. And it has weakened over the course of the last few weeks, but this looks like more of some consolidation following the appreciation rather than any clear sign that we're going to see significant additional weakness. The Mexican peso has also been strengthening up because the AMLO government has signaled a clear reluctance to engage in a lot of fiscal stimulus. So you therefore have the potential for currency market appreciation, and then there is a significant yield on fixed income investments. And it is these kinds of disparities in the market where I think investors are going to start looking at differentiation between the outlook for various markets. Obviously, it isn't as if Mexico doesn't have challenges. They haven't done an especially good job of containing the risk from the continued spread of the virus, and they have significant internal issues with regard to the strength of the drug cartels. But nonetheless, they are certainly trying to defend the currency. When I start to think about these issues over the long term, then we can think about what the immediate measures that are being deployed are, that we're getting this massive amount of liquidity infusion, and it's coming in fits and starts. And one thing that is particularly relevant at present time is that the Federal Reserve has been, in fact, reducing the size of its balance sheet over the course of the last month. And that has been in response to the economic recovery. They are very alert to this simple fact that the Federal Reserve has got two mandates. It's to try and achieve maximum employment and to control inflation. Well, they're not alert to the real risk of asset price inflation or bubbly activity because it's not one of their mandates. But what they are certainly alert to is that if the velocity of money picks up and they don't withdraw liquidity from the market, then they will certainly have an inflationary problem. So they have to reduce the size of their balance sheet. Now that is completely beside the fact that they have told us that they're going to buy $120 billion worth of bonds a month. So that is the data point that investors are still trading on, that they're expecting we're going to have continued monetary infusions. But as long as the velocity of money starts to recover, and economic recovery is certainly taking place, certainly online, but also in the previous coronavirus hotspots like New York and New Jersey, obviously there is a hit to potential economic activity in places like Florida and Texas, Arizona, and California in the USA. So there is then scope that the worse that gets, the more of a hit it will impose upon the velocity of money, and therefore we will see additional infusions of liquidity. And that is potentially what we can anticipate, or at least rationalize, the continued steady action we're seeing on Wall Street. I think that one of the more important points here is that we have now seen that the S&P 500 has not only been able to push back above the 3,000 level, but it is demonstrating support in the region of the trend mean, and that is really quite positive action. When we then think about how are the majority of shares doing inside the index, well, the advanced decline line for the S&P 500 continues to trend higher. And in fact, it's really not very far away from putting in a new high. Now, there is the potential that it may in fact do it over the course of the next few weeks. And that would be confirmatory evidence that we are back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment for the S&P 500. When we look at the NASDAQ, it continues to extend its breakout. And this is quite different from anything we've seen since April. There is clear evidence now that the pace of the advance is picking up. And the hallmark of this trend since April has been every time it pushed on to a new high, it pulled back into the underlying range. And it is no longer doing that. It could quite easily have pulled back on the 2nd or the 4th, but there was no follow through, and it has subsequently continued to extend the advance. So we are increasingly looking at an accelerating trend in the NASDAQ 100. And it is the only index, or the only major index, that has demonstrated support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average and subsequently just cruised straight back into a new all-time high. I think it is also relevant to pay attention to the logarithmic scale chart, because even on a logarithmic scale chart, the pace of the advance is clearly picking up, and the clear move through 10,000 is a very significant psychological barrier that is now in the rearview mirror. So we have seen a really very profound rebound, and there is the continued scope for additional upside. But what it is also helping to demonstrate is that following a 12-year bull market, the pace of the advance is picking up. If that's the case, then we are potentially being set up for a type 1 top formation eventually, which is acceleration. Acceleration is a trend ending, and the pace of this advance picking up is certainly falling into the acceleration category. There is a growing temptation to think that stocks can't go down, that the types of companies that are powering growth in the Nasdaq, which are the mega caps, that they are uniquely placed to benefit from the current environment. And that has certainly been true over the course of the last 4 months. But the other point is that when we look at the logarithmic scale chart for Apple, for example, then its hallmark of consistency over the course of a decade has been that it can find support in the region of previous peaks during medium-term corrections, that the medium-term corrections until only recently lasted approximately a year and a half. Now the pace of the advance is picking up. And that also suggests that the next area of potential support on a pullback is going to be in the region of the previous peak, which is probably somewhere around the $300 to $325 area. Now, if we then look at some of the other shares, we can certainly see that the pace of the advance in Apple is picking up. But Microsoft's pace of advance is also picking up. It has continued to rebound and has been doing so in a really quite impressive manner. But of course, it hasn't been trending higher for as long either. It really only broke out of its base formation in 2013 and 14 when it adopted the subscription business model. Amazon has been the go-to share over the course of this bull market, and it continues to extend its advance. It's been a stellar performer over the course of this entire bull market. It has been prone to some bouts of volatility, and there have been occasions when it has gone sideways for upwards of a year, and arguably it has really just done that, and it is now cruising through the 3,000 level. Now, we can also look at the advance and say that when the ranges have been resolved on the upside, it is prone to accelerations, and that then it moves into these lengthier periods of consolidation. Well, that would suggest that when Apple's acceleration ends, it would really need to pull back into the underlying range in order to even begin to question the uptrend consistency. And that means then that the potential for extraordinary volatility is not really going to be enough to question the resolve of investors, because anyone who has continued to be an investor in Amazon without having been shaken out during any of the purges that have gone on over the last decade is probably not going to be shaken out by a 50% decline the next time either. But $2,100 is probably going to be the Rubicon where it needs to find support if the trend is going to remain consistent. Netflix has also broken on the upside, and it was among the best performing shares in here today, and it continues to extend its bull market overall. You will notice that I'm using a 1,000-day moving average because I believe it is by far the most useful average to use in a secular bull market environment. And then, of course, there is Tesla, which is I've quite regularly described Tesla as a lightning rod for speculation and global liquidity. and it is prone to extraordinary pullbacks, going from 1,000 to 400, in fact lower than 400 in the space of only about 4 weeks, is an extraordinary pullback, and yet it was the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range. Well, what that also helps to suggest is that $1,000 now should offer an area of support. Of course, that would represent a nearly 40% pullback from where we are right now. So we can definitely think then in terms of the third psychological perception stage of the major bull market, that we are certainly looking at accelerating trends among the best performing shares. And valuations and the outlook for continued appreciation is really very significant in here. There is certainly a lot of enthusiasm being built into some of the chip producers. Nvidia, for example, has broken on the upside and continues to extend its bull market. When we think about the valuations, it's trading on a price to sales of 21. And that's really quite extraordinary. When we start to think about, what really is the potential? Is Nvidia truly worth more than Intel? That's a very significant question, because Intel is just now in the region of its trend mean, and it has double the sales of Nvidia, and yet it's trading on a price to sales of 3 and a bit. So there is obviously some really clear disparity between companies that are arguably reasonably priced and those that are really clearly now accelerating. Of course, the main point about the divergence is that Tesla, Netflix, Amazon, and Nvidia are all part of the FAANG index, and so is Alibaba and Facebook. The Chinese shares have been lagging, but they have now clearly broken on the upside. Alibaba has certainly been one of the most popular of the Chinese shares over the last decade. Baidu has been probably one of the least popular and has pulled back violently over the last 2.5 years, but it has started to now show greater signs of increasing investor interest. Twitter is the standout in terms of failing so far to have really fired on the upside. Now, of course, one thing that I think is also representative of this evolving mania that we have in the mega cap technology shares is that there is an increasing threat of antitrust, and it's not affecting the shares at all. Now, eventually, it could potentially have an impact. To the extent that companies are broken up, then the constituent parts of those companies have generally gone on and done well. But if it introduces additional competition and forces companies to share technology, share market share with their competitors, then that can contribute to a significant period of underperformance. Well, then I think it's also worth considering that with the extraordinary performance of the mega cap shares, then it is being clearly driven by liquidity and by the clear assumption that extraordinarily low interest rates are very favorable for growth stocks. That has also been one of the causal factors behind the clear outperformance of private assets over the course of the last decade and more, that when you have extraordinarily low interest rates, then investors have to chase a return, and by betting on a basket of startup companies, all you need is for one to become a star to compensate for losses in 90% of the others. And that is enough to generate the kind of yield that investors require. But the other side of this argument is that eventually we're going to have higher interest rates. The fact that we have extraordinarily low interest rates is directly contributing to the low return environment. I thought this was a particularly interesting chart from Epoch, where they're looking at the declining impact on growth from debt. So there is this enormous amount of debt that's being produced, but the growth potential from the debt has been trending downwards now for more than 30 years. Well, these are significant issues because we've already seen that global interest rates are at the bottom. They simply can't go into negative territory without significant repercussions. We also know that the banking sector is looking really quite susceptible to weakness. The S&P 500 banks index was in positive territory today, and it is somewhat oversold in the short term, but it has been underperforming by a wide margin. The regional banks index was in positive territory today as well, and at least it is now holding the sequence of higher reaction lows, but with the potential for continued low interest rates, then it's hard to imagine how banks are going to make money. When we think about the challenges that the Bank of England has, then that is weighing on the banking sector in the UK, and so is the fact that it's heavily weighted by HSBC, which is a very significant Hong Kong bank, and was in significant negative territory coming off its highs in here today and just about steadying in the region of its lows today. It's hard to imagine that the situation in Hong Kong is going to get better. In fact, the geopolitical competition between the USA and China is probably only going to get worse. But when we start to think about, well, what are the near-term repercussions of this massive money printing and extraordinarily low interest rates? Well, it's helping to fuel the asset price bubble in the mega caps. So that's certainly one significant outcome from it. But eventually, we're also going to see that inflationary pressures are going to rise. And gold prices were above $1,800 for a period this week. They're still holding around the $1,800 area. This represents a rather important psychological area, considering that $1,800 was an area of resistance all the way back in 2011 and 12. Now, we do have a short-term overbought condition. There is potential that we may get some consolidation in this area, but it would be hard to question the bull market hypothesis here. With extraordinarily low interest rates and negative real interest rates overall, then there is the clear scope for gold to continue to outperform. What we are also now starting to see is that gold shares are breaking on the upside, and the GDX Gold Miners ETF pushed on to new recovery highs in here today and appears to be completing a first step above the base. When we look at the junior gold miners, then they are just now in the process of completing their base formation. Now, I think this is one of the more important points. It's that gold shares moving to outperformance relative to the gold price is a hallmark of the beginning of the second psychological perception stage of a bull market. Gold generally has to start moving first, and then higher beta plays on gold tend to move second. The beginning of the recovery in precious metals started back in 2015, when we had the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend. Then we had a lengthy period of base formation development, and gold started to do much better nearly 2 years ago and gave the first signs that it was on the cusp of completing its base formation. Then it did it in 2019 and has extended the bull market in here in 2020. But gold shares broke up later. Junior gold miners are only just on the cusp of breaking out, and it's really only been in the course of the last few months that gold shares have significantly started to outperform relative to gold. The number of companies that have got an all-in sustaining cost below $1,000 is comparatively small. There are more companies who've got a higher all-in sustaining cost. Well, that's, I think, one of the more significant factors, because those companies offer more leverage to the gold price. They have been among the less good performers in the sector so far, which was a clear indication that we were still in the first psychological perception stage of the bull market. When, for example, we look at some of the best performers, they have got some of the highest performing, or some of the best performances overall, because they've got some of the lowest cost of productions. That's certainly the case for Petropavlovsk. So that's been a significant rebound in here this week following some boardroom shenanigans that saw the share pull back rather significantly, but it has continued to hold its progression of higher reaction lows because of that low all-in sustaining price. It's exactly the kind of share that should do well in the first stage of the bull market, but with gold shares and junior gold miners starting to outperform, then that is, I think, evidence that we are approaching the beginning of the second psychological perception stage, which is acceptance. Clear confirmation that that will be the case, or that is the case, will be when silver breaks above $20. And we're not quite there yet. It's up now to $19, and it was in positive territory in here today, but it hasn't really been able to clearly sustain the move above 19 just yet. It's probably a little bit early to conclude that that is in fact the case, but I think it is inevitable that silver will be able to sustain this move up and away from the $20 area. When we think then about the various ratios, the gold-silver ratio is, I think, one of the most useful in this regard, because it clearly gives us the lead that gold offers relative to silver in the early stages of a bull market. That silver underperformed by a very wide margin between 2006 and 2007, but then it outperformed in incredibly robust fashion. And it then underperformed again all the way from 2011 through to now, and has only really just started to outperform again. So there is the potential here that silver is going to break its long, decade-long trend of underperformance and potentially come all the way back down to the lower side of this range, where it would be trading more like 50 times, or that gold would be trading more like at 50 times the price of silver. Of course, what that also means is that if gold is at $2,000, then silver would have to rally extraordinarily in order to close or to create that kind of ratio. So it's not going to happen overnight. But I remember all the way back when David and I were first starting to work together in 2003 and 4, when we were trading silver and it was still with a handle of $5, $6, and $7. We were of the opinion that silver would probably get back to the Bunker Hunt peak from 1980 before the bull market ended. And that's what it did, because the Bunker Hunt peak was around $40 and the peak subsequently was 50. Well, I do think that it is quite likely during this new bull market for precious metals that we're going to see that the nominal price for these metals goes up significantly. That it is quite likely we're going to see the peaks taken out in terms of purchasing power parity, and that it will subsequently offer an area of long-term support. What it also suggests is that investors are beginning to think about inflationary issues. Now, the big question that investors have been asking and debating over the course of the last decade is whether the peak in 2011 was a peak or the peak. And well, it's increasingly likely that it is not the peak, that we are very likely to see the peak from 2011 exceeded in US dollar terms. It's already been exceeded in a significant number of other currencies. There is the additional argument that this entire decade-long hiatus was just a period of consolidation following the acceleration, and that we are subsequently now moving into the next phase of a secular bull market in gold. And I've been debating that question myself. I was bearish of gold from approximately 2012 onwards, and I remember having an argument at the chart seminar in New York about the need to have an exit strategy in 2012. And I didn't really become interested in the sector again until 2018 because I could clearly see that we had very good evidence of base formation. So, and personally, I think that if you're going to go through a 7-year hiatus, then still relying on a bull market hypothesis is not really how you can make money from a sector. But today we certainly have new bull market. We certainly have a case for a new bull market. But one other factor that I think is interesting is this chart. And I picked it up, I think it's probably 2 years ago. And I think it's extraordinary that we had a trend higher from 1955 to approximately 1980, that when the Federal Reserve was tightening in the aftermath of recessions, that they tightened progressively more on each occasion until 1980. And it was the raising of interest rates by more than 1200 basis points in the late 1970s that helped to kill off inflation. And then the number of times they had to raise interest rates before there was a recession, well, then that compressed steadily all the way through until 2000. But one thing we've seen since then has been that when interest rates have been rising since 2000, they've been able at least to raise them more. Now, I think that it is worth highlighting that between 2015 and 2020, interest rates did not go up over 500 basis points because the Federal Reserve only took them up by approximately 225 basis points. So they must also be looking at some additional information in terms of monetary phenomena to make this determination. But it is reasonable to conclude that if this trend started with gold in the early 2000s, was it at that point beginning to price in the change that we were potentially then only in the very early foothills of a new inflationary cycle, and that these things do not move in a straight line, but that there is an evolving situation where we are in fact in a new inflationary cycle, and that it is likely to unfold over what is potentially 35 years. And it is that other interesting point that this period from 1955 upwards to 1980, well, that was 25 years. We're now at a point where we are already 20 years into this new cycle, but we've also had this incredible hiatus where there were no interest rate hikes at all for a long period. And we're probably now in another one of those periods, because central banks have already told us that they're not going to raise interest rates for at least a couple of years, and they would need really very substantial evidence of inflationary pressures rising once more before they're willing to raise interest rates. But what this chart is telling us is that there is the clear potential that when they raise rates next, that it will be more than 600 basis points of tightening. And that's obviously something that would have to give pause to any bond investor, because it is by far the most risky sector right now because of this massive swell in the overall quantity of debt. So I think that is one of the clearest and biggest risks out there today. Now, we can still think about the pace of technological innovation. One of the clearest and I think the most profound influences on the global markets from technology is the fact that it does more with less, and that is inherently deflationary. So these tools that are being developed, they focus on disintermediation, which is cutting out the middleman. They are focusing on dematerialization, which is basically getting rid of physical objects so that the virtual world is becoming progressively more powerful and plays a greater role in the economy. Well, that necessarily has a dehumanization effect, because it is knocking humans out of the supply chain. Now, whether it can be believed or not, Elon Musk said that Tesla is very close to delivering level 5 autonomy. Well, if we do get level 5 autonomy, then the unemployment that has evolved as a result of the coronavirus could be permanent. And that's a sharply deflationary outcome, because you would no longer require delivery drivers. And if that's the case, well, then we're at a crossroads in terms of the fabric of society, because we are going to have to figure out a way to employ lots of new people. Now, one of the biggest challenges in terms of the global economy over the course of the last decade has been the high oil price, because not only is technology deflationary, but high energy costs, they force economization. They force people to do less because the price of oil is expensive. Now, we've been able to compensate with for doing less with the evolution of technology. But what we in fact need in order to stimulate economic growth and create a higher interest rate environment as a result and have any real way of paying down the debts overall is going to be with a new energy source that is more energy dense. Well, I've looked at this graphic on a number of occasions, and it's liquid hydrogen is the one that ticks all the boxes because its volume specific energy is high. It's not as high as kerosene, but it's as high as TNT. But its mass specific energy is orders of magnitude more than kerosene, because this is a logarithmic scale chart. So I pay particular attention to anything that talks about liquid hydrogen, because if we crack that nut, if we can figure out a way to harness the economic potential of liquid hydrogen, then that has got a potential to have a profound effect on economic potential. And we are getting increasingly close to that realization. Then we also know that there is this incredible amount of money getting poured into fusion research. And if we do eventually get success in that area, then it is going to be the result of incredible cooperation and the flowing together of trends in artificial intelligence, deep learning, and modeling, as well as the physics, the creation of new materials such as superconductors, and the realization that a great deal of research has already been done and funded by governments, and that commercial entities are trying aggressively now to also gain, beat them to the prize. One thing that we have seen over the course of the last 20 years has been the cost of genetic sequencing has compressed incredibly swiftly. Now, when we think about how that was achieved, there was the massive investment by government, and then Craig Venter came along and said that he could do it faster and cheaper, and he beat them to the prize. So that has then contributed to this incredible compression in the cost of genetic sequencing. I thought this was a particularly impressive graphic from The Economist. Then we also know that these types of compressions in cost have been and beating the government entities to the prize have been possible in other spheres. There is the attempt underway today to try and do the same thing with fusion and the ITER project, which is being built in the south of France. They anticipate having first ignition at some point in the early 2030s and eventually to have a functional fusion reactor. Well, obviously there's a clear intention to try and beat them to the prize. Right now, I think the biggest bets are in liquid hydrogen. And that's part of the reason why that I think natural gas prices are unlikely to continue to trend lower. That it will be the fuel for the hydrogen economy as it begins. It is just economics 101 that when you've got a very low price for a vital commodity, then people will come up with new ways to use it. What this is also helping to suggest is that we did have a very high energy environment very high energy price environment for a prolonged period, and that was more true of oil than gas, and it is now over. We're now in a low energy price environment, that the upshot from that is we're going to come up with different ways to use that energy. We're in an energy abundant market today, and we are now creating the potential to create an even more energy abundant market in future. Now, that it has the potential to burst the bubble in the debt markets. That's one of the things that has to be obviously something that we have to be most aware of. When we start to think about what the real economic potential is, then we know that there is massive technological innovation, and it has contributed to deflationary forces for most of the last 20 years. But that it can also contribute to a step change in how we look at our potential. And this continued drive towards looking for green technologies, the continued support for carbon credits, and the fact that carbon credits are now back at their all-time peak. That's all suggestive of this clear support for alternative energies. And that will eventually contribute to a new solution. Because one of the greatest challenges of both wind and solar sectors is that they're just not energy dense enough. And that will eventually contribute to their underperformance relative to new alternatives. So I do think that this is a subject we need to monitor. The fact that we are already at an extraordinarily low interest rate environment tells us where the risks are. If we start to think about the first, second, and third stages of bull markets, gold is now, I think, in the second psychological perception stage, because the junior gold miners are starting to perform. And I think silver will be not far behind. When we think about the third psychological perception stage, then technology shares are at the beginning of the third psychological perception stage. The pace of their acceleration is only beginning to advance. But bonds are probably well into, if not close to the end, of the third psychological perception stage. And I think that, therefore, has to be the sector we pay most particular attention to. And the way to do that is really simple, because the 30-year is going to be where the greatest risk is concentrated if we get higher interest rates. But a sustained move above 2% would be required to break the trend. And while there is some weakness in the market coming through with a bounce in the yield today, we are still a long way from taking out the 2% level. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.